every presenter hopes for, a gift of time. We're sorry for the reason. James Dark, who was to give the response, is ill with the flu and won't be making it this morning. So the time will be Paul's. His list of credits and kudos is very long, and I won't take his time. I know what it is to want more time in these sessions, but the things that he cared about having said about him are that he has his MFA from Columbia University, a professional degree in film studies. He was a professor of film studies for more than 4 years at BYU. He is a professional filmmaker currently working on documentaries and looking toward other aspects of filmmaking. I was telling him a minute ago that I heard a spot on NPR the other day about someplace, I can't remember where it is, where they're giving prizes to playwrights, and the playwrights are given a chance to give 10-minute segments, to have professional actors present 10-minute segments of their plays. If they go over 10 minutes, the judges have permission to throw wet dish rags at the performers. So I don't want to take any time and jeopardize Paul's well-being. This thought of looking at ourselves, at being unable to look at ourselves objectively and seriously, to consider ourselves as others see us, reminds me of Robert Burns' lines, "O would some power the gift he give us to see ourselves as others see us. O would it would from many a blunder free us and foolish notion, what errors in dress and gait would lead us, and even devotion." So I'll turn the time over to Paul Nibley.
Thank you. Because I have more time, it's kind of interesting because I work very hard to get this within the time limits. I'm used to giving a similar lecture in classes where I had 2 hours, and to get it down to 30 minutes was pretty rough. So as I feel gaps, I might leave the text and expand a little bit and therefore ramble some. I hope not too much. I want to leave some time at the end for questions and answers, because I would like to get your feedback too. Being a filmmaker, I'm very interested in what the audience wants, and it's hard to get that kind of feedback, but in this kind of forum, it's a real opportunity for me to get response from you. One of the most common and least understood of human experiences is dreaming. We all dream, but all scientists really know about dreaming is that it is an important biological or spiritual function of the brain. When people are deprived of dreaming, they go insane. The Russians used to use sleep deprivation as their ultimate torture. It's better than needles under the fingernails or anything else. If people are deprived of dreaming sleep, they go insane. Now, one of the functions of storytelling seems to be to augment our dreaming. It's a similar kind of experience. When listeners or readers of a story become involved in the story, they exercise their emotions just as they do when they dream. A good storyteller tries to make the experience of his story as vivid and realistic as possible, and thus make the audience involvement deeper and more dreamlike. In a dream, we experience a strange separation of self that doesn't happen in waking life. We are in the dream, talking, running, fighting, happy, sad, confused, embarrassed, but at the same time, we are outside the dream, witnessing it, and seeing ourselves from all sides. In a good story, the same separation takes place. We identify with the protagonist, and we feel with him, as we do with ourselves when we see ourselves in a dream. At the same time, we are outside of the protagonist's environment, watching him, and we can see things that he can't see, and we can know things that he can't know. In the more sophisticated forms of storytelling, there's a cast of actors in a controlled setting to make the involvement in the story more intense. Temples were the finest storytelling facilities in antiquity. They were the state of the art then. Modern theaters owe a lot to the ancient temples. Modern theaters still call the room underneath the main stage the green room. That comes from times when the theaters were temples, and the green room was a stage of its own underneath another stage. And the green room was the stage that represented a garden in a drama that continued on the other stage later when the characters were forced out of the garden and the audience followed. That's even carried over into television now, and the room where you prepare to go on the air is called the green room, though it's almost never painted green, and a lot of people don't know where that comes from. At present, the most sophisticated form of storytelling is film. In a dark theater, people forget where they are and become totally involved in the story on the screen. They can move through space and time just like they do when they dream. Now, I can't tell you what the rest of the audience was doing the first time I saw Rocky, because I was too involved in the story myself. But I went a second time, and I watched the audience around me instead of the film. During the fight scenes at the end, the people in the audience were incredibly involved, and I saw them jerking and twitching like dreaming dogs while Rocky was getting his punches and giving them. And they were actually moving in their seats and twitching and going, ooh. The involvement was so intense. Now, I'm not a critic, so I can't talk about the value of Rocky as a piece of art, but as a filmmaker, I can say that it's storytelling at its very finest. The involvement with the audience was incredible. People didn't know what was going on around them. They were in the ring with Rocky fighting, and yet they were outside of the ring witnessing it. Now, I've always wanted to be involved in the kind of storytelling that comes close to a dream experience, but the stories I want to tell are about Mormons, and I and others who I know who want to tell stories about Mormons have met a strong and strange resistance from the Mormon community. The stories that we want to tell are about people that we know and relationships that we witnessed or experienced. We're excited and even passionate about our stories, but we're told by worried people that the stories might damage the church in some strange way. A cliche I often heard is, we don't want to air our dirty linen in public. In 1968, I was dating the daughter of a stake president in the San Francisco Bay Area. Visiting general authorities usually stayed in the stake president's home during their conference assignments, and I was always invited to dinner on Sunday afternoon between sessions. One such conference visitor was Elder S. Dilworth Young of the Quorum of 70, whom I consider to be a fine Mormon poet and a man of great taste. He was an old friend of the family, a grandson of Brigham Young, and had grown up with my grandfather. During the course of the dinner, he asked me what I was going to do with my life when I got out of the military. I'd already been bitten by the film bug and knew that I wanted to make movies. He asked me, what kind of films do you want to make? Like most young dreamers who want to make movies, I had not thought much about what I wanted to put into the movies. So, referring to a film that I'd seen the night before in stake leadership meeting, I said, I want to make films that will help the church, like the one we saw last night about working in the Sunday school. Brother Young pointed his fork at me and said, don't ever make a film like that. He told me that no matter how clean and wonderful it made us feel, the film was a disservice to the church. This confused me incredibly. And we had quite a talk about it. But this wasn't the resistance that I mentioned earlier about making films and telling stories. In fact, it was exactly the opposite. Brother Young felt that the Mormon community was a wonderful source of dramatic material of the very internal conflicts that embarrass more defensive Mormons. What Brother Young wanted to see was movies about dramatic conflict and humor unique to Mormon culture. Movies about Mormons that would compete in the theaters with movies from Hollywood. He never got to see one, and as far as I know, none has ever been made. One religious minority that has made movies about itself is the Jews. When there were fewer Jews in the United States than there were Mormons, the studios that still dominate the motion picture industry were built by a handful of Jewish immigrants from Germany and Eastern Europe. These men resisted films about Jews in the same way that Mormons resist films about Mormons. They tried to remain ethnically anonymous. It was as though they were ashamed of their background. And they didn't want people to know where their accents came from and where their childhood had been spent. And they produced movies about their personal idea of a perfect Protestant American community. It's interesting that all those Andy Hardy movies were produced and directed by Jewish people. Some courageous directors insisted on making movies about the people that they grew up with and knew best. The very first movie with synchronized sound, The Jazz Singer, is about a Jewish cantor's son who breaks his father's heart by singing jazz instead of canting in the synagogue. The movie was a huge success, even though virtually no one in the audience outside of New York and Los Angeles knew what a cantor was or anything else about contemporary Jewish culture. Despite the success of The Jazz Singer, Jewish writers and directors always met resistance from the Jewish studio heads when they tried to make movies about Jews. But they persisted, and somehow a few of them got made. I'll digress a little bit here. That movie, The Jazz Singer, was made by the Warner Brothers, who were Jewish. And since they were brothers, of course, they had family conflicts, internal family conflicts. One of them was a real renegade, and he was the one that insisted that sound was the future of the movies and that you could make movies about Jews. And he won on this particular movie. They took a chance, and it was considered a strange experiment that was going to fail because movies had to be silent. Silent movies were the state of the art right then, and no one thought that sound movies would go anywhere. So they let this brother on his own off to the side make this stupid experiment that it was going to show him that he didn't know what was happening. And it ended up being the biggest movie success to date at that time, outside of the silent movie by D.W. Griffith, Birth of a Nation, yes. Okay. In the 40s, when anti-Semitism was growing in America as well as the rest of the world, the Jewish studio heads got together in a huge meeting and discussed the idea of fighting back with films that would show what was happening to the world with anti-Semitism. This was before the revelations of the Nazi death camps, etc. Several projects were started, but most of them were eventually scrapped. One that got made was called Gentleman's Agreement. It starred Gregory Peck as a reporter who poses as a Jew to write about anti-Semitism in New York. Gentleman's Agreement broke a wall of resistance from the Jewish community about airing dirty linen in public. After Gentleman's Agreement, it became more acceptable for Jews to make movies about themselves. In the 60s, a floodgate opened and lots of dirty linen was aired, along with some very bleached, clean, white linen. And directors like Woody Allen and Larry Pierce, who made a movie called Goodbye Columbus, started opening up the Jewish community for the world to see and sharing their culture, not on a religious level, but on an ethnic and cultural level. A public profile comparison of Jews and Mormons is quite interesting. The Mormons are proselyting people who are trying to get a message to the entire world, while the Jews are a closed society which is difficult to join even through marriage. One would think that a closed society would remain secret, while a proselyting society would become well known, but that's not the case. Many non-Jews have some idea of what a bar mitzvah is, and know that the bride and groom stomp on the glasses and say Mazel Tov at the end of their wedding ceremony. How many non-Mormons know what happens when a boy becomes a deacon or understand the phrase for time and all eternity? Everyone knows about the Holocaust, but how many know that the governor of Missouri once ordered genocide against the Mormons? S. Dilworth Young had a dream of people knowing about their culture the way they are familiar with, about our culture, the way they are familiar with the Jewish culture. He wanted Mormons to tell stories about Mormons to the world. It wasn't happening in the 60s, and it's not happening now. After 20 years of getting career advice from S. Dilworth Young, I found myself teaching screenwriting at Brigham Young University. A student in one of my classes wrote a charming story about a young Mormon couple. The husband works in the MTC, and his wife is expecting their first child. When the woman goes into labor early, the doctor prescribes an ounce of vodka every 30 minutes until the labor stops. This is a medically approved practice. There are drugs now that do it, but in the past, vodka was used. And in the story, the idea was that they had no insurance. They were depending on tithing alone as their insurance policy and could not afford to buy the drug. So he said, well, this worked in the past. It'll work now. An ounce of vodka every 30 minutes. The young man's problem was where and how to find vodka in Provo on Saturday evening and then how to get his wife to drink it. It was folksy and Mormon. It involved the home teachers and the bishop. It was very funny, and I was very proud that it came out of one of my classes. I had the opportunity to relate the story to some high-powered filmmakers who attended the Sundance Workshop for independent filmmakers the following summer. Jessica Tandy and Hume Cronin, Academy Award-winning husband and wife team that have been in many movies, loved it. They thought it was exceptional, and they really liked it. Ring Lardner Jr., who was a Jewish screenwriter, he wrote the original movie MASH. He thought it was just delightful. But the next year, when the student began production on his film, I was in for a surprise. Unfortunately, he had talked to someone over the summer who convinced him to eliminate all references to Mormons in the script. The logic was that no one would understand words like priesthood and home teacher or talk about missionaries. Because the characters were originally Mormons and received most of their motivations from the fact that they were Mormons, taking out their Mormonness reduced them to one-dimensional characters, and the story fell flat, and the film was pretty much a failure. This is not an isolated incident. I had trouble getting any student to write about Mormons at all. Almost every script was full of people who drank, smoked, had coffee for breakfast, worked as bartenders, slept around, or dealt with drugs. The characters were suspiciously flat, and when questioned, the students admitted to getting their characters from other movies and TV. The strange fact was that they actually knew real people to model their characters after, but they refused to use them. I would ask a student, do you know anyone who actually sleeps around? Yes, a guy or a girl I went to high school with. I would ask for a description of the guy or the girl, and then the class would respond. Inevitably, they would feel that the real character was much more interesting than the character in the script. We'd ask, why don't you use the real character in your script? And they would hem and haw and say, oh, but that character is not that interesting, and doesn't feel right. Why aren't Mormon screenwriting students able to write about Mormons? Very interesting. I'll digress a little bit here. It's interesting that this is not unique to the Mormon culture. When I was in New York going to Columbia University, we had the same problem with people from any background. All the young students who had little experience, they were usually in their young 20s, early 20s, had great difficulty believing that anything in their own lives was worth relating to anybody else. They were in movies because they tried to escape their own boring, mundane lives through the adventures that were happening in films. And they didn't realize that the characters in those films had to come from real life. So this is not unique to Mormons, Mormon students at all. However, the resistance to changing was incredibly solid, much more difficult than the students that I met in New York. Okay, we've all had the experience of seeing a photograph or a videotape of ourselves that we felt didn't represent us fairly. When we hear our voice on a recording or see ourselves in a photograph, we're surprised at what we see. There's that moment of, oh, that's me. We think we're seeing another person, and all of a sudden, that's me, but I don't look like that. This is usually a personal experience, but in the case of ethnic or religious minorities, it carries over into the group. I want to give some examples from a documentary film called Sherman's March. Is there anyone here who's seen Sherman's March? A few. Okay. I ask you not to talk to your neighbors and poison the well so that they can get the experience themselves. I'll give a little introduction of the film. Because we don't have time to screen the entire film, some introduction will be necessary. Sherman's March was made by a filmmaker who got a grant to do a documentary on General William T. Sherman's march through the South during the Civil War. The filmmaker, Ross McElwee, started making the film about Sherman, but he kept digressing to film his own personal life. He would take the camera on dates with him. He's an admittedly neurotic man who's concerned about his relations with women and obsessed with the possibility of a nuclear holocaust. Though he occasionally finds something about Sherman to film, most of the film follows him through one relationship after another and through his search for ways to survive a nuclear war. Our first clip is when a fundamentalist Baptist girlfriend takes him to a secret survivalist hideout. So I'll turn down the lights.
Claudia has invited me to visit some friends of hers who live in a settlement nearby in the mountains. Her friends have given me permission to film them, but only after I promise not to reveal their names nor the location of their settlement.
Our idea is to get people up here who have certain talents, like we're interested in talking to a doctor, also to a dentist, also to a veterinarian. And we've deeded some property over here to a genius in the mechanical field.
Mm-hmm.
Literally a genius. He can make almost anything out of anything.
Genius in the interior designers.
I'm going to look something out.
Are y'all building a shelter here?
Yep. What we're doing is we're going to use the basement down here as a fallout shelter, and we're getting lead shielding on the walls and ceiling in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have the whole thing done. We'll have a generator, water, root cellar, everything. Not to be paranoid, you know, but
just be prepared.
There's one left in the chamber.
I know there is.
I need that for rattlesnakes.
Dude.
The kind to crawl on the belly and the kind to walk on their feet, huh?
Yes, sir.
No.
There ain't much to do up here. There's, you gotta make your own liquor. You got, women are kind of scarce, wouldn't you say?
Pretty ones.
Pretty ones. And, but it's the greatest country in the world, it really is, and it makes you appreciate America and what God gave us.
It reminds you a little bit of the America of the 30s. People up here don't realize that the world isn't living yet. That's the little thing we haven't yet learned.
Mm-hmm. What we are basically involved in is isolationism, survival, and going back, if you will, to the movie Little House on the Prairie, where the family is the dominant factor in our lives. We've gotten away from the influences of the drugs in the city. It's also freedom from regulation. You can shoot a gun off the front porch. A fella can even bite who he wants to up here and keep out who he don't. There's a lot of people wanting to survive like we do, and they're coming back into the woods. And there's people who are becoming more and more conservative. I'm one of them. My son's one of them.
The people of our persuasion feel that the federal government is our mortal enemy. The only thing we want from governments at all levels is to simply be left alone. Leave us alone. You better leave us alone.
You know, one of the ways to avert a nuclear war is to make ourselves so doggone powerful nuclear weapon-wise that we no longer have any fear of anybody attacking us because of the fear of retaliation. We have allowed ourselves to become weak in our nuclear arsenal, so it's high time that this country take an isolationist viewpoint and get on with getting itself the strongest nation in the world, because you can't trust the communist. Quote, end quote.
Tell you, but one of them are going to put bass and brim in,
uh-huh.
And then the one they're going to stock with trout, and I think it's that one they've already got stocked. You'll have to ask them. And that's the way they're going to put the tennis court, is right down there.
So we'll be able to play tennis in case of a nuclear attack?
Right. They'll have everything they need up here in case of a nuclear attack to survive in style. It says after the rapture, after Jesus returned to the earth and he takes all the believers in Christ into the heavenly spheres with him, that there'll be a 7-year period left on this earth where all this nuclear holocaust and fire and brimstone and all that will happen. And at the end of all of this is the apocalypse.
And that's the end of the world, basically. And then there's the new heaven and the new earth that comes down from heaven and is placed on this earth. And I truly believe that's going to happen.
Okay, I'll just leave the light off because we're going to go back and forth. What we've just seen is Ross's impression of the people that he visited. He talked to these people and filmed them and then put together bits and pieces of the 2 days that he spent with them into a 5-minute scene. We as the audience don't experience it the way he did because he has eliminated a lot of boring conversation, bad camera work, etc. When he edited the material, he exaggerated his feelings of the experience and made things more extreme than they were in the actual experience. An example is where he asked Claudia if people are going to play tennis during a nuclear attack. Immediately after the question is asked, there's a cut in the film. Her answer is quick and confident and makes us laugh because it appears that she has entirely missed the irony of playing tennis while atomic bombs are falling. What we take for her answer is actually the answer to a different question, which has been smoothly cut out along with her real response to that question. Now, at first glance, this kind of filmmaking seems unfair and dishonest. If the filmmaker is in the business of propaganda or news gathering, it is unfair and dishonest. But most filmmakers are not making films for propaganda. Ross is a storyteller who's telling us about his own very personal fears and nightmares. He's trying to give us that dreamlike experience of participating and watching at the same time. He wants us to identify with the protagonist and experience his emotions. For most viewers, that is exactly what happens. But a problem arises for viewers who are closely aligned with the other characters in the film. Instead of identifying with the protagonist, they identify with people he is observing. The result is a confusing mixture of emotions. If there are any fundamentalist Baptist isolationists in the audience, I am sure that the screening made you uncomfortable and that you're now experiencing feelings of defensiveness. On the one hand, the people in the film seemed ridiculous. On the other hand, what they said was correct and made perfect sense. These confused feelings are what I want to elicit from everyone here, if possible, so that we can examine what they are and what we can do about them. I started with this particular scene because I assumed there would be very few fundamentalist Baptist isolationists in the audience. I would like to look at the clip again, and this time I'll talk over it and maybe stop and start it to point out how the material has been manipulated. First of all, before we start, I want to break the spell of the storyteller because film is a very powerful medium, and it's very easy to get sucked right into the story instantly. Besides it being a powerful medium, we have trained ourselves to do that. With the short snatches of TV we watch and things like 15-second commercials, we're used to being grabbed into this very quickly. It's almost like a narcoleptic who can fall asleep instantly. We can fall into a story instantly. Keep in mind that this 5-minute scene comes from several hours of actual film, the rest of which has been thrown out. Try to picture the situation as it happened, not as you were seeing it. The eyes that we are using are the camera that Ross is holding. So Ross, in one point in the film, we see him. He has placed the camera on a tripod, and we see him talking in a little trio by a cement mixer. That's at the beginning. But that's the only time we see him. The rest of the time, while the filming was going on, he had a camera on his right shoulder, and his left hand was moving the lens and the zoom, while his right hand was holding the camera, and he would occasionally move this hand down to a tape recorder hanging from his shoulder and adjust the knobs on the tape recorder. There was a microphone somewhere around. I don't know how it was held. He might have had one of the other people that were around there actually involved in the filmmaking and holding the microphone for him. You have to realize that this is what was actually happening, not what we see here. What we see here is just what the camera saw. And filmmaking is the elimination of the unnecessary in the scene. So what we're seeing is just what we are being told to see. Have to forget that and try and take yourself out of the story. Okay, let's look at it again. Now it starts out with a shot that filmmakers like shots like this. They're artsy.
Claudia has invited me to visit some
friends. But they like
them
for a reason. Ross McElwee teaches filmmaking at Boston University. And this distorted image right here, he would call it a foreshadowing image. He's going to see this little sequence is going to be a distortion of reality. That's how he feels about these people. So he starts out with just a very subliminal, very vague reference to distortion.
Claudia invited me to visit some friends of
and
hers.
And he's chosen to use this image.
Nearby in the mountains.
There's no dialogue in it.
Her friends
it's narrated
have given me permission to film them, but only
after I promise not to reveal their names nor the location of their settlement.
There he is.
Our idea is to get people up here who have certain talents, like we're interested in talking to a doctor, also to a dentist, also to a veterinarian. And we've needed some property over here to a genius in the mechanical field.
Okay, now so far, these people sound logical and okay. There's no problem with it. As the scene goes along, he chooses clips that make them sound a little bit more and more paranoid. But he starts out with this guy sounding pretty good, and then he lets this guy bring in the idea of paranoia. He lets him say it. At the end of this scene.
Literally a genie. He can make almost anything out of anything.
Genie's in the interior designers.
Well, we'll look something out.
Now, there's our first cut. Now, she said, do you need any interior designers? And she obviously realized that interior designers are not survivalist-type occupations. And so when she asked him, his response is just his voice. Then we cut to a very serious-looking face. He might have actually laughed. But we don't know, because the filmmaker has cut that out and made him probably more serious than he actually was. I mean, he's sort of chuckling along with it, but Ross is giving us a little bit more stern image here.
Are y'all building a shelter here?
Yep. What we're doing is we're going to use the basement down here as a fallout shelter, and we're getting lead shielding on the walls and ceiling in the basement. Mm-hmm. So we'll have the whole thing done. We'll have a generator, water, root cellar, everything. Not to be paranoid, you know, but...
Just be prepared.
Okay, now, cutting right from him saying not to be paranoid, what's the next thing he cuts to? Shows it might be a little
there's
bit
one left in the chamber.
I know there is. I need that for rattlesnakes.
The kind of crawl on the belly and the kind of walk on their feet. Huh?
First, definitely paranoid statement.
I couldn't hear what was.
He says the kind that crawl on their belly and the kind that walk on their feet. It's for rattlesnakes. It's for government agents. It's for people who don't believe what we believe. Okay? Now, this is cut to a different time. This is was filmed during a different time of the day. This camera angle is from a viewpoint where this man is sitting down. We just cut from him standing up. So there's actually a jump in continuity. This goes through smoothly. People recognize that in some scenes he's standing up and some scenes he's sitting down. But it's been done very smoothly in the editing room. And though you realize it, you discount it because the conversation, the dialogue, flows so smoothly through. And the way that's been done is that he will hold on an image like this and start the sound from the next image before he cuts from it. So it sounds like the other person is talking right after he does. The two men will talk back and forth, but if you will listen to what their voices are and where their images are, you'll begin to see that it's not the way the conversation took place. That he's cut out all of his responses and questions or whatever, and he has them just talking.
What's the deal up here? There's you got to make your own liquor. You got women are kind of scarce, wouldn't you say?
Pretty ones.
And but it's the greatest country in the world. It really is, and it makes you appreciate America and what God gave us.
It reminds you a little bit of the America of the 30s. People up here don't realize that they go.
What happened? I think my battery ran out. Okay. I have four batteries. Don't fear.
Survivalist.
Okay, now, get it started again here.
America of the cities. People up here don't realize that the world isn't living yet. That's the little thing we haven't yet learned.
Yeah.
What we are basically involved in is...
What's that? That the world owes them a living.
Oh.
He's being sarcastic. Uh-huh. He's saying people haven't learned up here that the world owes them a living. Now, so far, up to this point, he's set up the way he wants to edit the conversation with an actual camera move. Here, this man is talking. The other man's voice...
It reminds you a little bit
over
of the America of the cities. People up here don't realize that the world owes them a living yet. That's the little thing we haven't yet learned.
Yeah.
What we are basically involved
now,
in
the
is...
The other man's voice starts over it, but we cut to him and he's standing up. This was filmed at a different time. And yet, it seems to us as we watch it that it's part of the same dialogue, that it's going straight through. I'll let you see that again.
Living yet. That's the little thing we haven't yet learned.
Yeah.
What we are basically involved in is isolationism,
yeah,
survival,
right.
And going back, if you will, to the movie Little House on the Prairie, where the family is the dominant factor in our lives. We've gotten away from the influences of the drugs in the city. It's also freedom from regulation. You can shoot a gun off the front porch.
He's done it again. He did it with the same guy.
Fella can even ride who he wants to up here and keep out who he don't. There's a lot of people wanting to survive like we do, and they're coming back into the woods. And there's people who are becoming more and more conservative. I'm one of them. My son's one of them. The people of our persuasion feel that the federal government is our mortal enemy. But anything we want from governments at all levels is to simply be left alone. Leave us alone. You better leave us alone.
Okay, that's about as paranoid as he filmed them. And so he ends with that one. And the next thing we go to...
You know, one of the ways to avoid a nuclear war
now he talks about
is to make ourselves so doggone powerful, nuclear weapon-wise, that we no longer have any fear of anybody attacking us because of the fear of retaliation. We have allowed ourselves to become weak in our nuclear arsenal, so it's high time
that
this country...
That was even a jump cut. It's the same guy talking. Remember, there's only one camera here, so it couldn't have been like in the TV shows where they cut from one camera to another. It had to have been during a different time of the day when these
in our nuclear
dead.
Arsenal. So it's high time that this country take an isolationist viewpoint and get on with getting itself the strongest nation in the world, because you can't trust the communist. Quote, end quote.
Okay, now he's had them getting more and more paranoid. The things that they say are more and more paranoid as they build up. Now, over the 2 days that he was visiting them, and you can tell it's 2 days even though it seems like one afternoon because they change clothes. But there's at least 2 days involved here. And then he cuts from this talk that builds up, and their most paranoid statements have been stacked so that his overall impression of them as paranoid comes across to us in just 5 minutes. And now he has them shooting at sticks of dynamite, which he might have actually even suggested to them. We don't know. But it gives us the impression that he got that these people are a little bit on the wacko side. Dog is the filmmaker. I'm sure that he identified with the dog right there. Every time a gun goes off, the camera jerks. I mean, he was frightened by the gunshots. And he's showing us that. These people kind of scare him.
He ain't heard me tell you, but one of them are going to put bass and bran in,
uh-huh.
And then the one they're going to stock with trout, and I think it's that one they've already got stocked. You'll have to ask him. And that's the way they're going to put the tennis courts right down there.
So they'll be able to play tennis in case of a nuclear attack?
Right. They'll have everything there.
Okay, did you see the cut?
Yeah.
You see the cut? Let's look at that again. Now, when he asked her so they can play tennis during a nuclear attack, she probably laughed. I mean, it's a funny thing. It's a very ironic statement. He cut it off right after he asked the question and cut back to a different thing that he had filmed where she was talking about how, yeah, they're going to be all prepared. They're going to have everything that they need. And it makes it look like she's missed the point entirely.
You're going to play tennis in case of a nuclear attack?
Right. They'll have everything they need up here in case of a nuclear attack to survive in style. It says after the rapture, after Jesus...
Okay, we don't need to see the religious stuff again. This was of interest to him in the film. So, okay. So, you see how filmmaking works. And that's what it's supposed to do. Now, an interesting phenomenon that I've observed is that in many cases, the defensive feelings are not only the fault of the film that seems to be causing them. Who is in the audience with the viewer also has an effect. For example, if the clip we just saw were screened at a meeting of Aryan Nation or some other isolationist group, the reaction might be one of admiration for the men in the film and extreme interest in the success of their settlement. It might be followed by a question and answer period where people would seriously consider following the example of the people in the film and plan their own survivalist community. If, on the other hand, the same audience were here with us and had heard the chuckles and laughter from those of us who do not share their beliefs, they would feel very uncomfortable. Now, the next clip takes place about a year later in Ross's life. He has left Claudia behind and gone through two other women in his search for security in a relationship. An old friend decides to come to his rescue and help him find a woman who will share his views on survival and make him happy. The clip starts out during an early meeting between Ross and the new girl, Dee Dee, where Charlene, the matchmaking friend, tries to do away with traditional courting and get right to the point. Okay, lights.
Now I'm giving you a few more hours to deal with you, even some time alone, to get used to the idea, because the wedding is happening. I want you married by Christmas. That's this year.
That sounds close.
Time is wasting. It's to be a Christmas wedding. Ross, you understand me? Ross, you're getting married this December. See, before I ever met you, I was longing for Ross to meet a woman who was not sullen. And who, what else was it, Ross? I had it down pat. I wanted her to not be sullen, and I wanted her to be...
Rich.
No, I did not. Rich. Rich does not matter. You're the one with that responsibility. You have to make some money. You have to put that camera down and make some money. I'm considering putting you into dentistry. Anyway, this won't do. This won't do. This child is a beautiful child, and she must be supported while she raises your children.
I go home with Dee Dee to meet her mother.
Right.
When she speaks of supplies, she means everything.
Right.
For survival.
Aid. First aid.
First aid. Really survival things.
Yeah, everything.
Everything. It's a terribly expensive...
As well as food.
...proposition. And the place to store all this material within the house itself is almost impossible.
I better come around on the other side.
Alright. Reset for the light. And there's the three boxes, 25 pounds of low fat imitation dry milk.
And where's the water kept?
In the water.
In the garage. Want to go out that way?
Water safe at any temperature. Isn't that right? And that's what we're doing the algae. Right.
You're giving away all your secrets. I'm going to know where everything is now.
So this is 2 6-gallons of water.
Oh, underneath.
6-gallon container.
Really?
We have another gallon container and a 5-gallon container in the laundry room.
Mm-hmm. And then you have a warehouse which has a good bit of food.
6 weeks' worth of dehydrated food.
Okay. Now, I'm stopping here to skip ahead because the relationship between Ross and Dee Dee is interrupted at this point by a scene about General Sherman that would take too much time and is irrelevant to the discussion. So we'll just go right on where the courtship continues.
You don't drink coffee or Coke or beer or anything. How do you live in the 20th century?
Hard to live in Charleston, let me tell you. No, it really is.
Is it health reasons, the caffeine?
It's, I'm a Mormon, member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Is that part of, I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
And Joseph Smith was indeed a prophet whose mission it was to restore Christ Church in its fullness in these, the latter days, the days prior to the second coming. And
I didn't realize that's the latter days.
That's what that means. America is the promised land. And this nation is chosen by land as this land. And that we believe very vigorously that the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were divinely inspired documents. It's no accident that the United States of America is the kind of nation that it is.
Do you think that the possibility of the Third World War is figured into the Revelation?
Yes, yes, because we've been told that there will be great destruction prior to the Second Coming. But, and this, of course, is part of why we think we should be prepared with our storage of all different kinds, because there will be wars and rumors of war. The pregnant lady, a mother who's expecting a child, doesn't know the hour of its birth, but she knows when she's in her ninth month that it's not going to be next year. We're in that sort of latter days now. We're the signs of the times all around us.
Okay, we'll stop it right there. Now, while the spell of this film is still simmering, I want to ask you to savor the emotional flavors of this clip that we just saw. The first time I saw this film, it was with a non-Mormon audience in a theater. And my reaction was very strong, my personal reaction. I felt a lot of emotions. I began to suspect that Dee Dee was a Mormon when I saw the powdered milk in her house. But I dismissed it. When I found out that she didn't drink Coke, I was sure that she was a Mormon. I was embarrassed and groaned out loud and sank down into my seat when she announced her religion. When she talked about Joseph Smith, I cringed at every cliche that I myself had used so often. I didn't understand my embarrassment, and I didn't consider for an instant that the rest of the audience didn't feel exactly the same way I did. Since that first viewing, I've screened the film many times for friends and classes at BYU. During those screenings, I've carefully monitored the reactions of first-time viewers, and I watched you today. Ethnic Mormons, as opposed to converts, usually experience some uncomfortable emotions, like I did during this scene. Some cover their faces with their hands. Others scrunch down in their seats. There's often a groan of embarrassment when Dee Dee says she is a Mormon, and especially when she stumbles saying the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Non-Mormon audience members show some amusement, but no signs of discomfort. And recent converts, to whom the cliches have more meaning, often have feelings of pride in Dee Dee's courage, along with some delight in that the joke is on Ross and his matchmaking friend. Now, unfortunately, we didn't see the whole film here, and the experience is weakened because the clips are taken out of context that they were meant to be in. Hopefully, some of the impact remains, and I did see some of the impact on a few people here. We got that reaction. The feelings, and you still had some emotional response. The feelings that come from the feelings that you felt come from the same confusion of identities that happens when we hear our own voice on a recording, or catch that glimpse of ourselves in a mirror out of the corner of our eye, or look at the picture on our driver's license. The filmmaker has given us the best version of his experience that he can put together from the material he has shot, and the story is structured to make the viewer identify with him. Even though the sound and picture from the restaurant are quite poor, he included them in the film because they were essential to relate his experience. Most viewers identify with Ross and find what Dee Dee says quite interesting, as did Ross. Mormon viewers, however, are too close to Dee Dee and identify with her as well as with Ross. The confusion of emotions from playing two parts at once, as we view the film, produces a kind of stage fright. And we fear that Dee Dee is going to say the wrong thing. Audience members react to the situation as though they were in Dee Dee's place on some kind of hot seat, undergoing an interrogation. The fact that she's well prepared and handles the situation very well is no comfort at all. In my experience, most Mormon viewers are so involved with Dee Dee that their own confused emotion and their own confused emotions that they fail to understand how Ross himself feels about Dee Dee and what has just happened. In the next scene, Ross describes his feelings, but the confusion from the preceding scene usually lingers long enough to make people miss what he says. Now, I've had a break here so that you can collect your senses again, so listen carefully to what Ross says about Dee Dee, how he feels about his experience with her.
This is Fort Moultrie, and it's about a mile from Charlene's house. I have to be careful because the rangers have told me that I'm not allowed to film here without permission and I could get into trouble, so I'm trying to do this sort of low profile. Also, there are Boy Scouts all over the place, which makes it harder to film. But Charlene is really serious about Dee Dee and me. I mean, she laughs a lot about it, but she's serious. She thinks it's ridiculous that I haven't been married yet, as old as I am. And so she offers me this woman of purity and strength and conviction. And she has the voice of a singing angel, and she's from a prominent Charleston family, and whose dowry apparently includes, you know, a better than average chance of survival in case of a nuclear attack. But, you know, I'm just not suited for Dee Dee. I'm unsuited for her. You know, basically, Charlene doesn't realize I have these tendencies toward depression and sort of anxiety, and that I'm sort of lust-ridden, and I don't know, it's not going to work. Last night, Dee Dee told me she wanted to marry a man who could bring the priesthood into our home, and that's just not me. Oh, here come more Boy Scouts.
What happened with Dee Dee? What happened last night?
Did you know she was a Mormon?
A Mormon? Well, I didn't know it at first. All I knew was that she was a singer and an extraordinary one. I knew that she was a singer. I knew she was beautiful. I knew she had charisma.
Well, I don't see why you thought we had that much in common. We're actually very different people. You know, she intends to marry someone from the Mormon church, someone who can bring the priesthood into her house.
What? You want to tell me that again? Who can bring the priesthood into her house?
Yes.
Ross, I counted on you about that. I figured even though Dee Dee was a Mormon, at the moment she saw you in your Gatsby clothes, that religion would be just something she realized was a stall for time.
She's very serious about her religion.
She's only serious about her religion because she has it, because she's not in love. If she would fall in love with you, then it would be different. Well, she blew it with Dee Dee. But while you were gone to Atlanta, I found a girl who's better than Dee Dee. I found a wonderful girl for you. She looks like the angel on the top of the Christmas tree. She's absolutely perfectly beautiful. She's not a Mormon. In fact, she sleeps around. I can't wait for you to meet this girl. She's gorgeous. She's darling.
Okay. He ran out of film, but his tape recorder kept going right there. Okay. As you can see, there's no reason for Mormons to feel embarrassed or defensive. Ross describes Dee Dee as a woman of purity, strength, and conviction. He rejects the peace of mind that her religion gives her, just like he rejects solutions to his problems every time they are offered to him throughout the film. This is not a film about solutions. It's about neurotic self-absorption. Non-Mormon viewers quickly recognize that of all the women that Ross becomes involved with, Dee Dee is the easiest for him to reject because she is the closest to what he claims to be seeking. If he were to continue his relationship with Dee Dee, he would find actual solutions and no longer to be able to wallow in self-pity the way he seems to enjoy so much. We're out of time. Okay. That's just about all I've got. The emotional roller coaster that happens to Mormons when they see themselves in films is not pleasant for most of us. Rather than experience that ride, we tend to trust our public image to advertising people, public relations people, who can make us feel comfortable. To be sure, The church needs good publicity, and I have no quarrel with the official church image. But where is our Woody Allen? Where is our Mel Brooks? The official image of what we should be and wish we were is not what we are. To see ourselves as a Donna Reed family, where Father always knows best and there is always a happy ending, keeps us from examining the real conflicts in our lives and finding solutions for them. Storytelling and dreaming are closely connected. Perhaps storytelling is a kind of social dreaming. Individuals deprived of unrestricted dreaming don't function normally and eventually become insane. What will become of a culture deprived of healthy storytelling? When the angel described in section 88 sounds his trumpet and reveals all the secret acts of men and thoughts and intents of their hearts, only those who have never shared their secrets will be truly embarrassed and ashamed. We have a chance to prepare for that angel by telling our stories before he comes. Hopefully, the Mormon Gentleman's Agreement, or Fiddler on the Roof, will soon be made, and the world will have the privilege of knowing about our very unique culture, and we will become a healthier and more functional culture at the same time. Thank you. Yeah, love to answer some questions. Yeah, Dan.
The very first of the movie, or the clips you showed, the filmmaker, I think, is using the novelty of the camera to make his subject look dishonest. The gentleman in the cowboy hat keeps shifting his eyes back and forth, and I guess this was before he was comfortable with the camera and kept looking at the camera to see, I guess, if he was going to talk back to him or something.
Mm-hmm.
But the shift of the eyes made him appear that he was trying to size us up as we watched him to see if we were worth telling his secrets to.
Yeah, and seeing the clip out of context, it does that. However, you've got to remember that he had this camera on his shoulder all the time, and everybody he talked to shifted eyes. So by the time you get to this clip in the film, you're used to that grammar. That kind of camera work, and it doesn't have that much impact. But you're right, in this short segment, it certainly does. The lighting was what was available to him. He had no control over the lighting whatsoever. He had a camera, and he went out there, and he set the f-stop and shot it. He got a good exposure, and that's all he could do. Fortunately for him, in North Carolina, the skies are usually cloudy, and so he had a nice soft light most of the time. There is no official lid. No, there isn't. Where the difficulty comes is, though I've written scripts, other people I know have written scripts, there's no money available for it. And the church is not interested in producing films. In fact, they just closed down the motion picture studio at BYU, which was doing some film production, sort of independent. They did some things for Disney and for HBO. No, because there are no funds available in Hollywood to independent film producers. The nature of the business is you go out and you raise the money. But when you go to wealthy Mormons to raise money to do a film about Mormons, they read the script and they say, well, you've got to take out all the references to Mormonism. And that's their personal thing. It's not an official thing at all. I haven't felt any official pressure whatsoever not to make my films.
There have been some films about Mormons come out in the past, independent films, like I'm thinking one called Brigham in 1978 that was just atrocious.
Uh-huh. That was not made by Mormons.
Yeah, but, mm-hmm. Other things, I'm thinking of another one called Solo about the young
right.
family.
That one was made by Mormons. However, it wasn't seen by very many people.
It was
made by Lyman Dayton.
Which one was worse, but they were both awful.
Uh-huh.
Have disasters like that help to keep the lid on funding for movies in an LDS context?
Yes, of course they have, because the Mormon community is not that large, and though we have a high per capita income, the same people get hit all the time for funds to make these movies. And the movie makers that made Solo, for instance, Lyman Dayton, has ripped off a lot of people. And a lot of people are very unhappy with him as a Mormon filmmaker, because that's the way he approaches them. I'm a Mormon, I'm going to make this good family film. Only one of his films, that one, has mentioned Mormons. The rest of them have been all good family fare, some of them better than others. Where the Red Fern Grows was probably his most successful. Yes?
How do you value the impact of
Yeah, I wanted to address that and just didn't have time in this forum. I wanted to show clips from several different films, like Paint Your Wagon, which shows polygamists in a Western. And there have been films made about Mormons by non-Mormons, a lot of them. There were